Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
The Unconventional Soldier. A military podcast brought to you by two British Army veterans in association with ISAR.com.
Welcome everyone, and thanks again for downloading another episode of the podcast. This episode is on the Indian Staff College, which our guest today, John Holden, attended. I remember John sharing some of his training and tactics employed and taught at this defence institution, and I believe the listeners will enjoy John's story of his time there. So, John, welcome back, and thank you for sharing this period in your military career.
Thanks very much, and thank you for having me back. It's worthwhile, I suppose, saying at the beginning that so this podcast itself precedes the one I gave last time, because you may recall, and I remember listening back to it, where I started that last podcast by saying that I'd returned to the UK in May 2003, straight from India, to assume command of 473 Battery. So this period is from May, June 2002 up to me returning back to the UK.
So John, what took you to the Indian Staff College?
I suppose, as usual with me and my military career, it was never really a straight story. 2002, and I was a staff officer in the UK's Armoured Division, which was based in Germany, Hereford, to be precise. I was a targeting or a deep fires officer, so my title for the military types was SO2 targets at 1 UK Armoured Div, and I was eligible to attend Staff College because 5 years earlier I'd attended my junior staff training and I passed it with sufficient marks to progress along that career route. But as with all matters in officer training and education and promotion, there was a degree of selection as well. You had to pass what was called AJD at a certain grade to be considered for promotion. But then, in addition to that, you had to be selected. And as part of this, you had to submit your preferences. And I personally was never really inclined to go to the UK's own staff college. I know it's very prestigious and one of the world's best, but it didn't really flick my switch. And as I always wanted to go to one of the overseas colleges for a number of reasons. Partly because I like the adventure, but more importantly, I wanted to study through the eyes of a different military. And I happened to put India as my first choice, and then Australia as my second. And I can't for the life of me remember my third. I know it wasn't the USA, because I would never have gone to the USA. That was, you know, your future generals would always go there. And anyway, in 2002, so I think I would have been about 33 years of age, I was actually stood on the poolside at the Army swimming pool down in Aldershot because I was managing the Army swimming team. I mean, you two remember that. I was quite big into Army swimming and trying to get the guys into the pool most weeks. And we were preparing for the Tri-Service Swimming Championships. Swimming has always been in the Army one of those sporting underdogs, underinvested and lacking the support from the generals. But we had a good team. And I'd been the Army champion on a number of occasions and had captained the team as well. So as a major, it was my turn to manage that team. I was on the pool side, and I remember it's clear as day. I got a call from my boss, who was back at the headquarters in Germany. And I remember the phone call as if it was yesterday. As in many ways, that phone call changed my life and shaped my future until this day. And it was a Friday morning. I can't remember the exact date. And the phone call kind of went like this. John, how do you fancy going to India? Oh, when? Next week. Great. How long for? A year. What for? Staff college. Yep, I'll do it. I'll be back in the office on Monday. And so with that, I remember handing my clipboard over to a colleague. I got in my car, drove back to Germany. I reported back to my boss on the Monday. 96 hours later, I'd handed my job over. I'd closed my quarter. I had an apartment while I was there. Sold my car, given my dog to a close friend to look after, sorted my residential visa out, packed, sorted out all my financial affairs, and I was on a plane to Delhi. From Delhi, I flew down to a city called Coimbatore in South India, and I was met by a driver who knew I was coming. I didn't know he was even going to meet me, who took me to what would become my home for the next year. The drive to the military base, it was a cantonment, was a two-hour drive up to what was called the Nilgiris Mountains, and it was about an 8,000 feet climb up in the military cantonment of a town called Wellington, which, as you can imagine by that name, was an old British Army officer retreat near the town of Kunur, which was just down the road from a holiday resort called Ootacamund, or more affectionately known as Ooty. Now, Ooty itself is an old British holiday resort, and the base still had some... that and Wellington and Kunur still had some of the old infrastructure in place. The cottages, for example, in Wellington were the British office were the cottages that British officers could use to have some downtime from their time when they were based over there. And there was still an old cemetery of former British military personnel, and that was discreetly tucked away, unkempt, on the hillside.
Would you feel the effects of altitude at that height?
Yeah, you do a little bit, most certainly. I used to run quite regularly with my Australian friend. We used to run around the tea plantations. And yes, you did, but not as much, and we'll come on to it later on about one of the tours. But yeah, most definitely, at 8,000 feet, you do start to feel it. But it doesn't really impair you massively. And certainly after about 2 weeks, you're fully acclimatised at that altitude. I remember... as I got to my house, I was met, again, no one told me this, I was met by four house staff, and they literally came with the house. And in many ways, if I did not agree to continue employing them, they would have lost their job, because it was kind of just handed over. The house I went into was occupied by the previous British occupant, and so these staff just were handed from one to the other. My driver was a guy called Alexander. My head of house was an elderly lady called Ratnan, who effectively became a sort of like a street auntie. She ran everything. She ran the house, she ran the street, and she was sort of like the maternal head of all the house staff in the road. My childminder, remembering I went there as a single guy, was a lady called Susie, who I employed as my cleaner, because, as I said, I had no kids. And then a lady called Papadi, who was my cleaner, actually became my tea lady and my charwala. And it sounds weird, but it is what it is. I paid them out of my own army salary. So and it didn't cost that much, but I paid them probably more than what the local Indian officers paid their staff, and I put a structure in place for overtime and stuff like that, especially for Alexander when we went on our weekend trips to you know, places like Bangalore or Mudumalai into the jungle and places like that, he would be given an allowance so he could come along and, you know, so he was quite happy to do it because he made quite a lot of money, I suppose, relatively. So I ran them, and so Papadi's job was to meet me when I came back from the college. She met me at the door with a tray, and this was her job. She met me at the door with a tray, and on that tray had to be a cup of tea and a slice of banana cake that Ratman had made that morning. And then she would stay while I was doing my college work until about 5 o'clock, and then she would disappear. And that was her job, and it was fantastic.
This must have been a bit like End of Empire sort of time, really. Absolutely. Did that give you a concern?
Yes, and that's what it felt. A little bit, but you countered it because, you know, as an army officer sort of in the early 2000s, I was uncomfortable with it, but I knew the money I paid them. I mean, Ratnan had a servant's quarter in the back of the house, and these weren't big houses, but she had a servant's quarter, yeah. And I never asked how many people lived in her quarter. But I know, for example, I paid for her nephews and her nieces' graduation parties, their birthdays. And for us, it was tens of pounds. But for them, it was massive. It kept families going. And I know, for example, because I once turned up early and my house and my washing machine was being used as a cottage industry. It's just I turned up like 3 hours early. And they were industrially using the washing machine and cooking food for families. So my grocery bill was probably paying to feed other people. So it was quid pro quo, really. And, you know, everyone benefited, which is why I didn't have the heart. There was just me. I did not need 4 staff in the house, but I didn't want to terminate anyone's employment.
Yeah, and if you make them unemployed, obviously it's a massive impact on them.
Correct, and they weren't. And and so, you know, they came across with the house. And so only afterwards do you realise that day when I turned up, whenever the new Brit turned up, must have been a nerve-wracking day for them. Because, you know, there was no formal agreement. And if I just turned around and said, thanks very much, I don't need you, there was nothing. There would be no severance pay. There's nothing. They'd be just out on the streets, having lost the ability to feed the family. So I kept them for a year, and they were absolutely lovely. And they looked after me. And I was taken ill a few times because obviously of the food and the climate and everything else. You're not used to it. And they looked after me amazingly. And my house was always tidy. I always had food on the plate. And all I had to do was focus on the studies and the college. And so that's exactly what it was for. And beneficial because it was a beautiful place. As I say, it was 8,000 feet. You look down onto this steam railway track that ran up to the tourist town of Ooty. It was nestled in the heart of the tea plantations. Beautiful places to run around. And I know we'll come on to it later. So I bought myself a Royal Enfield Bullet, and we would ride around those beautiful mountains on your spare time with the sun setting. It was idyllic. It was amazing. Anyway, so to take that story on, I can't remember the exact date, but I remember arriving at the house on a Saturday. So, and I had my first rude awakening on the Sunday morning when an Indian colonel knocked on the door to introduce himself as my sort of DS, for those, you know, non-military, my directing staff, who would be my directing staff for the year. And that first introduction didn't go down very well, because he promptly told me off in quite a stern way for not having the decency to inform him of my arrival, noting that I only really knew about 96 hours before that I was definitely going. Anyway, he rapidly became introduced to me and got the curt response they probably deserved, and I told him off for not having the decency to meet me at the airport and relying on a member of staff who really didn't know what I looked like. So that shocked him a little bit. And that kind of set the tone with him as a man and my DS for the rest of the year. And then the course started literally the next day. So I had like 36 hours to acclimatise. And then we were on it. We were on the course the next day. And the first week was solely for what the Indian College would call the Friendly Foreign Nations. And the students, I think, were from about 28 nations, if my memory serves me right. There were 3 students from the UK, two from the USA and one from Australia, and then many other countries from the Middle East, Africa and the Far East. And the officer from Uganda is one student who always stuck out. He's a major general now, I know that, and I googled him recently, and I believe he is, or he was until recently, a high-ranking general in the United Nations. And so these officers from other nations, they, because he wasn't the only one, you know, they progressed onto real senior rank. And I know this Ugandan major general is really influential over back in his own country. And so week one really was all about induction and familiarisation with the college itself and with the Indian military. But the Indian military is a really secretive organisation, and you can understand why when you understand the politics of the region. And so although we were students on the course, they would never really ever divulge exactly how the army in the real world was compromised. Safe to say it was close to the organisational structure that we used throughout the course itself. And so when we talked about a 14 core organisation, which is their size, so you can imagine how large that was. And it's very personnel heavy, with over sort of 40 divisions. And at UK, well, we had two regular divisions at that time. So it talks about, you can give the example. And they prided themselves at that time, I think they had one really Western standard division, and the rest were, you know, it was more personnel heavy because of their main threats, as you can imagine, were, you know, internal borders, along with primarily with Pakistan and China.
I mean, just to put that into context, though, I mean, at the height of the Cold War, the British Army, we only had one corps.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. I mean,
it is huge.
14 corps.
Yeah.
And did you have a mixed joint, British influence and Soviet influence? Because did the Indian Army have quite a bit of Soviet kit?
You have hit it right on the head. Yeah, you have hit it on the head. So the equipment was predominantly Soviet. So absolutely, they were increasingly buying Western equipment, but it was predominantly, and the majority of sort of like the residual corps and the divisions, less for their premier ones, were Soviet in nature. And so their tactics had to support that equipment. But their culture, a lot of their doctrine, and we'll come on to some of it, some of their doctrine, they were trying to move towards Western. So they were, and you can see the correlation between, you know, British, our military culture, and theirs, and that overlap, and where the two come together. So they have a Western influence, obviously, but their equipment was tactical, so their level of command was very prescriptive, because a Soviet doctrine requires a prescriptive level of command. So when the course started proper the following week, I can't remember exactly how many students there were exactly, but I think it was about 500 to 600. They were broken down into syndicates, and I was allocated a syndicate sponsor, who again he and I just didn't click at all. So I adopted an Indian. He was a Tamil officer from the infantry, who also is now a major general and is 3 years away from retirement. And I still keep in touch with him. And again, because they're serving, they can't use, they're very strict. They're not allowed any social media. So it's WhatsApp conversations and stuff like that. But I keep in fact, that's four or five I keep in touch with quite a lot, because there were some really cracking guys. One of my next-door neighbours was Special Forces. Another one of my next-door neighbours was Para, you know, and they had significant operational experience up in the border regions, certainly up in Jammu Kashmir. And then the course starts. It literally just kicks off and away you go. And I had a look over some of the old notes, but the course was broken down into six primary modules, and they were military organisations and communication techniques, international relations and strategy, analysis of the tactical problems and process of decision-making, planning and management of combat resources, evaluation of combat effectiveness and study of industrial sectors, theory and practice of contemporary warfare, India's national security, modern military challenges and responses, and strategic aspects of area studies. And in addition to the course, each student had to write an essay as part of their submission to qualify for their master's degree, which was in Defence and Strategic Studies from Madras University. So I have a degree. I have a master's degree from Madras, which is fantastic.
Before we go on to what your degree was, John, can you just cover for civilian listeners who might not know, what is the importance of a staff college qualification to a British officer?
It opens doors for further promotion. I think for non-military, without it, because it is a master's level of study, it is a master's level, which is why it's easy to get a master's degree running parallel with it. So it's that level of academic study, and without it, you're capped in terms of your career progression. And because it demonstrates a level of academic understanding to the art of warfare, I think is a fair way of saying it. The MSc you get is in what's called Defence and Strategic Studies, so that's what the master's degree is. And the dissertation I wrote in order to qualify it, and it did get some pushback, was on women in combat, because the Indian military had women serving, but they were kind of like the very old WRAC that we had, and they weren't transitioning into the combat roles that we had. So I remember that my dissertation was on that, and I wrote it in order because it would be marked by the university and by the college, and so I wanted to be provocative, and I wrote it. I can see you laughing, and you probably know that's me. So yeah, I suppose the purpose of a master's degree is to push the boundaries, and I wanted to do that. So that's what I wrote. Yeah, that's what I wrote my dissertation on.
Is that still the case then with the Indian Forces, that women, are they now moving into all the other roles, or are they still operating in that way?
I don't know. If I can be truthfully honest, I don't know. I would imagine, based on their culture and the fact of the size of the military and the size of their population, that they don't need to. Because a lot of their military is, when one of their young soldiers joins the regiment, it really, that family is, their salary might not be brilliant, but the family is cared for. And if the soldier is killed in combat up on the border regions or anything like that, or is, then the family don't have anything to really worry about, because it's drawn from what is in many places an agricultural economy rather than the cities, I would imagine. So within our cantonment, there was a Madras regiment based next door as well, obviously. And so, they have that locality to Madras. That's a very, very rural area around the city.
What do you think, how long it's taken us to get females the access that they have to all combat roles now? I mean, it's only this week we had a first female actual parachute regiment badged female past P Company and is now serving in the parachute regiment.
Yes, absolutely. And don't get me wrong, I'm sure that if and when it does happen, the women who are drawn into the Indian military will be just as competent and just as capable. I do recall seeing them in small numbers around, but as I say, my recollection from that time was they did remind me, and the roles that they were undertaking were very similar to what we would have had as the WRAC. And I think if we talk through those modules, because each module lasted about 6 weeks. But there are a number that stand out for me that really made that year absolutely, amazing and worthwhile. During the course, we underwent two tours, two real noticeable tours, and each of those tours lasted for 2 weeks. So you were away from the college for 2 weeks. So out of a year, I was away from camp for effectively a month. And the first tour was through the industrial heartland of India, and it was all done by train. And so this was a military sleeper train and a purpose-built military sleeper train. So you can imagine that, again, because of the requirement and the primary risk, which is border conflicts along the majority of their land-based borders with Pakistan and China, when they mobilise, they need to mobilise their military personnel quickly. So they rely on their train network to get and aircraft as well, but train primarily to transport military personnel into the operational theatres. So we just, whether it was designated for us, but we had one of these trains for 2 weeks. I've got to say, it was by far my favourite time in India. Basically, we got to travel that 2 weeks on a sleeper train through the heartland, and it was called an industrial demonstration tour, as the stops were to allow the students to develop their understanding of India's industrial and emerging IT technical capacity that could support defence. So we visited places like Hyderabad, Secunderabad and Pune. They're the three sort of cities that really stand out for me. We often travelled through the night to get to our destination and would wake up in the morning where we would commence, you know, our specific tour. And on the occasions when we would pull into an area for more than one night, which was quite often, we would be, certainly if you were able, whether you were an Indian officer, I believe, or a foreign national officer, you would be allowed to stay in hotels, which made it feel more like an RAF tour. And I would spend hours in the evening when we were travelling from destination to destination, sat in the doorway of the train, my feet sticking out of the door with a beer in hand, watching rural India just pass me by, chatting endlessly with my Australian colleague. I lost so much weight during this part of the tour because we were fed from Indian railway stations, and it is traditional Indian food, and the spice level for me was just off the charts. Nothing wrong with the food, it was great, but it was just far too spicy for me, to the point that I simply couldn't eat it at all. And I'm not joking, it was so bad that my colleagues on the train in my carriage would literally swap, because apart from laughing as I was projectile sweating all over them, they would swap me my food for their pots of yogurt, which I would then supplement with food from the sort of railway cafes on the, whenever we pulled into a station, I would rush out and then pick up things like Mars bars and the like, and then eat those. And then I would catch up with the proper food whenever we stopped over at the hotels, as our allowance from the embassy would actually permit us to do that, and staying in good quality hotels like the Taj chain or something, or the Oberoi, I think it was called, with the type that we would stay in. And I think the point to draw from this tour was that India had and has a significant industrial base. I mean, it is large. And so we saw all varieties of factories and industrial capacity. And I recall visiting one factory, for example, and it was designated in building cars and lorries, primarily trucks, for defence, but it also had a line running for cars. And at that time, they were building the new City Rover. And they were extremely proud that, you know, they were building the car for us. And now, that car already existed in India. It was called the Tata Indica. And it was just being rebadged and shipped over to UK to be sold as a Rover. And they were really proud of that because, obviously, if you look on the reviews, it doesn't get a good review in England. But it just showed you that they had capacity and that we hadn't anymore, really, to a certain extent. Now, if memory serves me right, I do remember that we went to visit a tank. And again, it was shrouded around secrecy. I think it was the Arjun tank, which was their homemade tank that had been sort of designed in the 90s and then rolled out in the early 2000s. And it was complementing sort of their, you know, their later suites of T-class tanks that they had, and supplementing the majority of sort of the T-72s. The interesting part for me was how the Indians managed to show foreign students the best of India while managing to balance that against that default position of secrecy verging on mistrust to a certain extent. And it was based on the fact that, as I say, the entire course was run without ever divulging the entire structure. Because I know if you went to the UK course or US or Australia, you would dive into our real structures because that's how you would, because whatever you would plan and whatever you would exercise would be based on real world scenarios and real world organisations, but not in India.
What was that distrust? Where did that come from?
Hard to say. I think, if you want my honest opinion, I think it's regional. I think, you know, I've lived in the Middle East as well, and I think it is a default setting in that part of the world. I think in the West, where, you know, they probably look at us and would ask the same question, why we make it so easy to divulge our organisational structure the way we do. And again, it goes back to that opening question as why I wanted to go to Indian Staff College. I wanted to see military planning and military military thought through a different lens, you know, and they are very secretive. If you go online, you can't really download an orbat of what the Indian Army looks like. They hold that really close to their chest. And as I say, it's not just them. I would imagine it's the same in Pakistan. It was the same in the Middle Eastern countries where I lived as a civilian.
When you look at the relationships they've got in those borders and the tensions on those borders, that's probably one of the reasons they probably do keep it quite close to their chest.
Absolutely. And that's absolutely. But I think it bores deep in that. And I think it's a cultural norm. You know, it's why would, I think their position is, why would you want to make it easy for your organisational structure to be known by someone who is going to one day become your opponent on the battlefield? And so they don't. And as much as we were, as I say, officially labelled as friendly foreign nations, there's always suspicion. Going back to the tour, though, every time we stopped, the tour would include an event at a military base, and the foreign students in particular would be brought out, especially the Westerns, the US, the Brits and the Australian. And it was almost like a display. And it was a great opportunity, however, to see that rich cultural history of the Indian military and how you can still see those threads of Britain's influence running through that culture, as well as how theirs run through ours. You know, their uniforms, the focus on the bands and the structure and the way an event is managed and it's delivered. The similarities are just, it could be the same.
And we've got that overhang from Empire in India as well, with things like the slang we still use, sangers, dobi for washing.
Yep.
All that sangers, type of thing.
Dobi.
Bed, yep. Isn't it?
Absolutely. Totally. It really is. And it crosses over both ways. It really does. The next one is after that tour, and I think this was straight after the Christmas leave, we undertook a 2-week tour of India's operational areas. So this was putting you right into the operational zone. Now, for me, you had two choices. There was always, you could go one way to Jammu Kashmir, and you could go the other way to the Indochina border. Now, the year we went, I think the Jammu Kashmir, because they split you into two, the group that went to Jammu Kashmir, probably that tour was suppressed because India and Pakistan had a disagreement earlier on in 2002 that had caused the staff college to delay its start. And so for risk purposes, that you wouldn't have gone as far forward to the front line as you probably otherwise would in previous years. Whereas for us who went up to the Indochina border, we were right on the borderline. Now, we flew to the region by Antonov, so a double-decker Antonov, and then we broke down into smaller groups where we flew to our own mountainous destinations by HIP. And I'll always remember that flight, because I've never flown at such an altitude in a helicopter, having to suck from an oxygen mask whenever we felt short of breath. So, Cole, when you're talking about, did you feel this 2 weeks, absolutely, altitude sickness crept in massively. And I remember sort of being quite lightheaded and quite feeling quite faint in the helicopter and having to draw on that. Wasn't expecting it. You know, there was no training or prep. It was just feel faint, suck on that, and away you go. I don't know the exact altitude we flew at, but I know I've never been that high before. We went to various sort of formation HQs and their ops rooms, and they had the most intricate 3D models that had been developed over decades of that operational area, and they took great pride in that, and they were so colourful, and it was really strange, because I never really realised, it struck a chord in me when we did our first classroom exercise and that we undertook on the course, and that classroom exercise ran for a couple of days. And it was almost like the first day was always spent preparing the ops room and making that model very colourful. And I thought, well, this is really strange. You know, why would we be doing that and worrying, you know, to that level of attention to detail and all the trimmings that go with that model? And it clearly fixed the Indian officers. And I only understood it truly once I got to the operational theatre and you walked into the, you know, the brigade or the divisional headquarters, and you went into their ops room, and that model was absolutely, it was a work of art. But it wasn't just a model, it was everything around it. If you imagine the sort of the most colourful saris and everything in India, that colour And the artistry that goes with that culture, it manifests itself into the ops room as well. And again, that was a cultural nuance that would run throughout the entire course. And it continued into the operational settings, which you've both been in headquarters on operational tours, and you go into ours and there's no trim, there's no frill, but there it was. But these were static headquarters, again, based on their operational purpose, which was border defence, and so very static in nature.
Do you reckon that as well, because they're not relying on technology as much, they're still doing it the old-fashioned way, if you like?
Yes, absolutely. Now, remember, that was 20 years ago, but you're right, absolutely. It was the old-fashioned way. But you could imagine sitting in the ops room and getting a brief about, you know, a threat coming from an avenue of approach, and you could see it because these models were so large, you could almost walk it. I mean, you literally could stand over it with your pointer, and you could micro-navigate almost the route that you were going to do. It was detailed. And I do remember, actually, being on... They paid civilians at the college. So when you would do your exercises and your... each, whether it was offensive phase, defensive, mountain phase, and you went into the classroom first or the lecture hall, and they had the big sand model table in the middle, which was almost like, you know, 45 foot by 20 feet. You would leave that lecture room one night, you would come in the next day, and there was this sand model that was crafted to perfection, and it'd been done by a couple of these civilians that turned the model into a work of art. So it's a skill that they have that, you know, we've lost because, as you say, we rely on technology. And so these operational bases, they are covering contested borders. You know, these are operational, active areas. And in this case, where I was, I think at significant altitude, I think I was somewhere around, I was trying to dig out a photograph. We were stood at one of those, you know, signposts which gave you the altitude. And I think it was somewhere between 14 and 16,000 feet where my operational base was at that time. And I recall the areas I visited were Tawang and Tezpur, up on the sort of Bhutar area. And it was, I mean, we visited more because we were there for 2 weeks, but they were the main ones as the military infrastructure was everywhere. And what was impressive, really, was the resources it took to maintain that significant military presence at such altitudes. You know, it's quite clear that the Indian Army has its duty to defend those contested borders. So this duty sits at the very heart of their modern military culture. As I say, it's why they've got so many trains. It's, you know, to get them there. That's their primary purpose. And so, Kevin, we were going back to the quantity of military. Although they have, you know, a number of divisions that are, I would say, are of Western standard, the majority aren't. They don't need to be. It's quantity versus quality. What was clear, I mean, I remember visiting the hut on the border crossing point itself where the two sides would meet, and I do believe met after the 1962 conflict that India had with China, because I remember that being talked to me about meeting at the hut. And what was clear was that the Indian Army is most definitely geared up for its defence of its borders. I think, you know, it learnt a lot of lessons from 62. It was very successful in 72, and it's geared up and it can respond and mobilise very quickly. And that's what those numbers are. They're structured under that command in order to deliver mass at pace to defend the border, and they're designed defensive operations, you know, to do just that.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Interestingly, our staff college in 2002 was, as I said, it was delayed because of that localised conflict. And I think if I remember, it was officially classed as a standoff between India and Pakistan. And their policy, which is interesting, was to divert all their resources to the conflict rather than the UK, whose training institutions would continue through a conflict. You know, when we went to Iraq or Afghanistan, and ops before that, you know, all your institutions, your training institutions would continue. But no, their staff college stopped, and therefore the start point was delayed. And one of the issues with that staff college delaying was, because I think it was the course originally was for like a year and a half, but it was compressed into a year, and the commandant had to demonstrate that in order to get the course back to what it was originally, this is what we were told, they had to put the students under almost undue pressure to make it almost unbearable so they could say, see, we can't do this in a year, we have to go back to where we were. And so there was very little downtime for the foreign students to enjoy them, you know, the less sort of college-based activities. And we'd heard from previous students who said, oh, you'll be given time off to go and explore. And so we had none of that. I mean, we were very lucky to grab a weekend here, there, or, you know, Bangalore was a 7-hour drive and Mudumalai Jungle was over the other side of the Nilgiris Mountains. And so you could do that. But to go and get on a plane and go up to the Taj Mahal up in Delhi, no, unless you went in the Christmas break, there was no opportunity to do that at all.
It's interesting, John, you mentioned about the mountain fighting, because I don't know if you saw it a few months ago, there was a massive, actually was a punch-up, a physical punch-up on the border with Chinese troops, and a number of Indian troops and Chinese troops were killed.
Mm. Yes.
And then I remember reading an article a couple of years ago about the ability of the Indian Army's artillery to fight at altitude. The experts in that as well, and also the sheer number of casualties you get with altitude sickness, pulmonary edemas and everything. It's a dangerous environment.
Yeah, it is. And I was talking to a couple of their officers, because I think when I was asking, they, you know, the soldiers were up there for, they do almost, I think it was a 12-month tour, and you're right, these guys are up there for a long period of time, and they're not, The accommodation for the soldiers was not salubrious. I remember going into some of their accommodation, whether that was the QRF accommodation, but, you know, they didn't have their own dedicated beds. They were just sort of sleeping areas, and they would just have sort of like sections and platoons just all thrown into a room, and they were ready to go. So they were at a heightened state of operational readiness at all times. And so, as I say, you know, maintaining that level of capability and readiness takes a massive toll on their military, but it's what they're designed for, because that's their primary purpose. So that really leads me on to, I think, what for me was one of the best modules, which were, and you've just mentioned it, Cole, was the mountain warfare module, in terms of the academic understanding. So as I said, the Indian Army operates at altitude and their own territory, you know, within their own territory. So it was no surprise that it was one of the main modules of the course. And what was fascinating was that they still taught mule logistics in detail. You know, I spent about a week practicing the planning cycle of mule logistics. And the basis of their teaching went back to an old British doctrinal publication from the 1930s. We weren't allowed to keep them. So we couldn't keep any of the dockyard to hand them all back, and I believe but the planning assumptions were the same. And I always remember, I'll never forget, the planning was based on two different types of mules. One was mule GD, mule general duty, and that was a domestic mule. I kid you not, it was a domestic mule capable of carrying a load of up to 75 kilos. And then there was a mule artillery, which I believe, again, my memory serves me right, was an Austrian bred mule capable of carrying up to 150 kilograms. And the planning was based on on military-owned mules, but it was quite clear that, again, like most militaries, they could also contract that capability out to private providers who would use weaker, less cared for, you know, mules, domestic mules, to navigate the resources to the more hostile and inaccessible locations. And again, based on regulation, it was a military section, I think, was 14 mules, two of which were set aside for fuel and supplies and reserves. And the planning was exactly the same as you would do, say, in the RLC, where that you would do for vehicles, but just the planning timelines and the circular routes where they would go from one exchange point to another would be a lot slower and a lot shorter, and then you would just have these circular routes where mules would hang on. But yeah, we spent an entire week dedicated to that and planning those within the mountainous warfare, and it was absolutely amazing that they still plan it. I never saw any when we went up to the mountainous region, but they still, just like we did when we, you know, when the three of us were serving in the battery, we still did Morse code, I suppose. And I don't know if the guys still do it now in 2023, but we were doing Morse code in 1995. And in early 2000s, the Indian military was still doing, mule logistics.
I'm sure the Americans experimented with mules in Afghanistan on a very small scale, but I'm pretty sure they did.
Yeah. I mean, the mountainous area, the mule is your 4x4, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, it's going to go everywhere where you want it to go. It's not constrained by roads or paths in the same way that vehicles are. So actually, it just makes complete sense.
It does. And again, it's interesting, isn't it, that they designated two different types of mule, one for general duty and one for artillery, recognising that the fact that, you know, artillery, just as we would in a heavy conflict, you have dedicated artillery logistic lines in addition to your normal supplies. The other thing I remember when we planned the offensive operation, it was offensive, we planned an arm in the mountainous module, and it was, you know, we were trying to plan advance to contact, and it was how we went about mine clearance, you know, and I was applying again my Western doctrine of trying to, you know, to clear the pass, identify and clear the routes through technology and weaponry. And where theirs was, and this comes back to the size of their military, was putting the mine blast resistant boots on entire regiments worth of soldiers and advancing. And I couldn't get my head around it. The soldier is a scarce resource and is a human, and so we will treat them as such. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that what the Indians, the military, were doing differently, because if they didn't have the technology to do what we did, or they didn't have the systems to do what we did, they would still have to advance through the minefield. And so they found the solution by using, you know, well, we've got that regiment there, we'll put the mine blast resistant boots on, and away they go, and then we'll just send the second regiment behind.
I mean, what do those boots look like?
I don't know. I'm sure if you Google it, you could find blast-resistant boots.
I think I'll have to, because, I mean, that just sounds absolutely mad, doesn't it?
It's not something that we would do, is it? And I suppose that, and I'll come on to it, it kind of led me, because there were times when I could not get my head around alternate ways of military thinking. And again, it's why I wanted to go to a non-NATO staff college in the first place, because I wanted for my own military development to understand how other militaries think. Because if you constrain yourself to the belief that there is only one way to fight a war, then you are deluded. And if your opponent has tools up their sleeves that you wouldn't even consider, and that you won't think that they would use, you are putting yourself at a disadvantage. And so that, again, that's why I went to that college in the first place. And I suppose that leads me on then to that other aspect, of course, I'll always remember, was the final classroom-based exercise. And I remember it because it highlighted the difference between our two doctrines and why I wanted to go. So I was made the BMRA, for those, you know, outside the military. That was the Brigade Major of the Royal Artillery at divisional headquarter level. So I was the sort of the leading staff officer within the artillery side of that divisional headquarters. And I had to plan the deployment of the artillery within a defensive core level operation. And the Indian doctrine at that time was based on nodal defence, very static defence. And so our division had been allocated a nodal point, which effectively was a large town, to defend. And I, as the BMRA, was trying to apply that Western NATO manoeuvrist approach to defence and keeping the artillery in a position where it could be manoeuvred. It could continue to be manoeuvred for its own safety and to get to the best position so you could always, you know, apply force when and where it was needed. And but the doctrine there was to basically encircle all the assets effectively into a redoubt and surround it with mines and fight until there was nothing left. And I recall having heated exchanges with fellow students who in the end kind of, you know, I suppose I spoke with passion, who allowed me to apply our doctrine to that scenario, but informed me that in the process I would be the one who would have to stand in front of the DS and explain my thinking when it came to it. And I remember proudly standing in front of three generals, and I gave my artillery plan, only to be told it wouldn't work, and that I'd failed to understand that they had more than enough artillery in reserve, so its loss really wasn't a problem. And that, for me, was the core reason why it was always beneficial to keep alliances with others outside of NATO, because ours isn't the only way of doing things, and you have to have an open mind to tackle the problems in a manner that is different to what, you know, we would normally expect to do. Because if that's what they're prepared to do, you know, we don't care losing, you know, that regiment's worth of artillery, because we've got another 100 of them in the back. So just crack on. And it was like, no, we wouldn't do that, because every asset, whether it's a human asset or a material asset, is precious. Someone has delivered it to where it is. You know, if you haven't got that one, then you might not have another one. And so we use our resources very carefully, because we treat them as a scarce resource. But over there it was very different. If it was plentiful, then you could use it in a different way. And that came very I suppose it goes back to what you said, Cole. It's very much based on Soviet doctrine.
And you see that lack of care in Ukraine.
It is what it was.
Towards the Russians, towards their soldiers, who are, you know, they sacrifice them to try and break the siege around Bakhmut, I think it's called, where they're doing human wave-style attacks, just trying to wear down the enemy by sheer weight of numbers, something we would never even consider, you know.
No, we would use weaponry. We would do everything, and we would spend inordinate amount of sums to use doctrine and equipment to achieve that effect, rather than personnel. And, yeah, a lot more different. The manoeuvrist theory, it works for us because our doctrine is designed to support it. Our equipment is designed to support it. But and when you bring those two together, and Kev, I mean, you remember when we were in the Balkans in the 90s, and for the first time we were mixing with militaries that I'd never mixed with before. And, you know, I remember going up to that, you know, Soviet equipment for the first time, and it was an eye-opening experience. Because all of a sudden we were seeing things that we'd never seen, and we only heard read about in textbooks and stuff like that, and seen in slideshows when we were doing our armoured fighting vehicle recognition courses and stuff like that. And but you're right, Cole. I mean, don't get me wrong, I absolutely love my time. I love my year in India. As I said earlier on, we didn't get much time to explore outside of those official tours. As I said, that course had been compressed due to that earlier dispute. And I recall managing a few weekends away to Bangalore, as I said, and one weekend to a jungle retreat. I bought myself a Royal Enfield bullet. You couldn't not buy a Royal Enfield bullet when you're out in India. And I loved riding it through the mountain roads, through those tea plantations on your evenings when you'd finished your studies. Most of the Western students bought one also. We literally bought them en masse. And we used to ride into college in arrow formation with the US Marine Corps, who bought the biggest Royal Enfield bullet, as you can imagine. He bought the 500cc military, you know, matte green version, spearheading the group. And another one of my experiences was, and this was a real military treat, I was blessed to having the fortune of listening to a speech by Field Marshal Manekshaw, who he gave a really harsh lecture to the students one evening about who was to blame for sort of, you know, India where it was in its development status. And a lot of things. So you had these evening lectures about once or twice a week, and you would get academics in, and you get military people in, you would get business people in, and there were sometimes it was, you know, considering we were friendly foreign nations, there were times when it didn't feel friendly, let's say, and there was a lot, and it goes back to days of empire. A lot was blamed on us, on the Brits, but Manekshaw turned it around, and he blamed it on themselves. And their failure to learn and to apply change. And I recall that lecture didn't go down well with the domestic audience. I found it enlightening for a man of his age, and for whom India owed so much. He spearheaded their victory in 1972 against Pakistan. He was absolutely brilliant. But going back to my Enfield Bullet, I brought that bike back to the UK, and I rode it for a while. But I used to get harassed by men who are now my age, I suppose. And they would often stop me and say, well, is that an Enfield Bullet? And can I listen to the exhaust? Because the Enfield was a 350cc four cylinder single stroke, and it sounded beautiful. And so after getting stopped, I sold it to a member of the battery.
But a lot of people don't realise, though, that the Enfield machinery, all the factory.
Yeah.
Was sold to India, exported from the UK to India.
Yeah, correct.
And you're just thinking, why did we do that? Such a, you know, everyone wants one now.
Correct. I know. You can actually buy them now. They now export them to the UK. And I mean, I bought mine in India in 2002 for the equivalent of about 750 quid. And I bought about a year's worth of supplies as well. So when I sold it on to the guy in the battery, he had brake liners, brake everything, you know, everything, spare seats, spare exhaust, the works. The Indians were good hosts. And I, you know, as I say, I've still got some really good friends who I keep in touch with on WhatsApp and via LinkedIn and stuff like that. They tend not to do social media, certainly if they're serving, as I said. And I remember being invited round to the Commandant's house one evening for supper. And again, he regaled how we, the British, once owned this place as the site. And he reminded me that, you know, it'd been the military retreat for the British. And you had a golf course. It was up in the mountains. It was idyllic. And the houses the students lived in, they weren't there. But where the DS and the Commandant, they were the old British. And then there were some cottages where, you know, or effectively holiday cottages where the military guys would come for a weekend or a week or whatever. They hosted it in a way that would be familiar to the British. So when we went round to the Commandant's house, it was as you would do if you went round to your OC's house or the CO's house for a dinner night. But there was a kind of a subtle difference that, again, no one had prepared me or the other guests for. And the main event was the, you know, you would hors d'oeuvres, so the barges and all those Indian snacks that you get over here, that's what they serve. And they just kept coming because we just kept eating them. And as long as we kept eating them, they just kept coming. And the conversation was rich, and we were talking about lots of things. But by the time you sat down for the meal, that effectively signified the beginning of the end of the evening. So that the main part of the evening was the hors d'oeuvres, the standing and the drinking and eating the snacks, so to speak. By the time you'd finished your dessert, you were required to stand up and leave. So the dessert was the end. When you put your dessert spoon down, it was, I think the expectation was you go. But no one told us that. So it was kind of a few social faux pas until a couple of my sort of Indian colleagues told me, because, you know, we'd have the dessert and we would sit there by that time slightly worse for wear and trying to hold, you know, enlightening conversation with the hosts. And they were looking at you thinking, why aren't you going? You should be leaving now. And so you just, again, it was that cultural clash that no one warned you about. And it's one of those lessons that when I went and left the military and worked in the Middle East for a while, one of the things I told myself was, you know, you need to learn the culture really quickly, otherwise you'll end up making a mistake. And it was a big lesson, actually. And so the lesson I draw is always ask someone who's been before. There were challenges, however, and, you know, and I'd be lying if I said there weren't. Not all the sort of local officers liked our presence. Some of them truly did, and you mentioned at the beginning, Cole, about Empire. Some truly carried legacy issues of our joint past, and they would often refer to us in the context of your erstwhile empire. And that phrase used to grate with me. And I do recall a particularly tense part of a module. It was one of those evening lessons, and then it ran through the day, when the Indian Staff College used a scenario which was based on a real-world example of the Australians defending their borders against illegal immigration. And they did it in a way that, you know, really caused almost a political incident with the Australian serving officer there. And it didn't need to be done that way. But they did it nonetheless. And many of the evening lectures would challenge the West in a way that required us to go in preparing for a counter challenge, to go back. And so if we knew what the purpose of the presentation was, or we knew what the evening presentation was, we would probably have a chat with ourselves, and then we would go ready for combat, and we would counter any position that they had made, any statement that they had made, and we would throw back equally challenging questions to them. And sometimes you would come out sort of having, you know, with your adrenaline pumping, because that they really did push the boundaries. And again, it's like, do you really want us to be here or not? And I think in some ways that's why the Field Marshal Manekshaw presentation was so enlightening, as we came out from that and we were sort of like enthusiastic. And I remember going up to some of my Indian colleagues going, wow, wasn't that amazing? And they were like, no, we've seen it all before.
That sort of attitude that you're discussing, John, do you reckon part of that is because they're not a new country, India, but end of empire in India was, you know, late 1940s. Do you think part of that is because they want to be seen to be a country that's made it after the empire left, and there's maybe a bit of, not inferiority complex, but you know what I'm getting at? They want to be able to prove themselves that they're a country standing on their own two feet and just as capable and as good as Britain.
Yes. Absolutely, absolutely, and more than that, that they are on the ascendancy, and we are not. For those that, you know, for those that are probably less favourable to us, it's almost like, you know, you're not in the ascendancy, and we are large. We have the capacity that you no longer have, and you're no longer calling the shots. And to a certain extent, there's a truth there, isn't there? We are a small nation. Our military, in terms of its size and its capacity, has declined, but we are still a multi-spectrum military, and theirs is, for their size, they are focused primarily on their primary issue at hand, which is domestic within a what we would call, you know, in almost internal security, it's border. It's border defence against two, you know, pretty potent militaries who they have had recent encounters with. You know, you recalled a recent one with China that didn't escalate, thank heavens. You know, the last real major conflict with Pakistan was 72. That was the major one. But they have, as I say, they've had incursions and conflict where they do loose off quite a lot of rounds. And then China, the major one was 62. There's a different purpose. And so, but I think you're absolutely right. It's one of those things of, and I get it. You know, you've got a representative from a nation that once occupied you, and we no longer occupy them. And they are there to prove that they are independent, and they are. As I say, that's one of the benefits of that two-week industrial demonstration tour, was to see their industrial mass, and they were going to show it us. You know, they wanted us to go back and talk about, you know, that their capacity to produce at pace and at scale, because we can't do that. We don't have that capacity anymore, and they certainly do. But I did say that at the beginning, I had that phone call on that poolside back in May 2002, changed my life. My time in India created a friendship, in particular with an Australian artillery officer who then went on to help me secure my first job outside the army when I moved to the Middle East, Abu Dhabi, in 2013. And that's where I met my wife, with whom I've now got four children. So had I not taken that call or gone to India, I think my life would have been very different today. So I think, you know, I love my time in India, not only because it opened my eyes militarily to those other ways of fighting, some of those things that we discussed, but, you know, for the friendships made and those life experiences with Indian officers and the other officers from the friendly foreign countries as well. And I think that's one of the benefits of defence diplomacy, really. We get to meet people from different cultures and different militaries, and we've all done it. I know in your military careers you've met and served with people from, you know, many countries, and I think we're better for it.
Well, John, thanks for that. That was really good. I mean, we spoke about this before. I felt it was so unusual, because obviously I don't know anyone else who had been to one of the Indian Staff College or somewhere like that. And that leads us nicely onto Desert Island Dits. And for this episode, we're only going to concentrate on books.
Mm-hmm.
So, John, what book did you choose for this episode?
I chose the book that I'm reading at the moment, actually, and I'm reading The Operators, so Inside 14 in Intelligence.
Oh, yeah, seen that one.
It's a small book, but it's quite intriguing. Yeah, and the reason why I read it is I think it's my one regret from my time in the military. It was when before I joined 473, I served in 47 Regiment down in Thorney Island, and I was a trip. If you remember my previous podcast, it's how I met 473, because 10 Battery in 47 Regiment was assigned to 5 Regiment for the DRB tour to Northern Ireland. And before that tour, I was a typical young officer who just really wanted it. And we'd had the presentation from 14 in that were coming around doing the recruitment. And I wanted to try out for it. But I had my head, I was all loved up at the time, and so I never went for it. And it was the one regret, because by the time I think I realised that actually I should have gone and done it, it was too late.
And I've picked James Holland's Burma 44, The Battle That Turned Britain's War in the East. And when you look at India's contribution to the Second World War, there were 3.5 million Indian troops, 87,000 were killed, 34,000 wounded, 67,000 taken POW, and in the Far East, they were treated terribly by the Japanese. 18 Indian Army soldiers went to Victoria Cross. So a really proud tradition in the Second World War. And Field Marshal Auchinleck stated that Britain couldn't have come through both wars if it hadn't been for the Indian Army. They made an absolutely massive contribution. This book by James Holland focuses on the Battle of the Admin Box in the Arakan in February 1944, and it was the 7th Indian Division that took part. And this is a very well-renowned division that fought well throughout the Second World War. At this time, then, the better training and leadership under Slim was beginning to pay off, and he made a focus on no retreat, because previously, a lot of the times, the army, when they were faced with Japanese onslaught, would retreat. They're also getting in better kit, and they had trained so well that there was less fear of them being cut off. And actually, that was one of the tricks of the trade that they were going to do at this battle, was allow themselves to be cut off. But because they had brought Spitfires in, we had air superiority, and they were able to do lots of resupply by air, it meant that being cut off didn't engender the fear that it used to. And it was also at this time that we were realising the Japanese were not the masters of the jungle that everybody thought. And they were really a locust army. They had very poor logistics. They tend to live off the land. This meant that they could move quickly, but also meant that they could become overstretched very quickly too. And there's great examples in the books about how they were very poor tactically. There's a chapter in it where it describes a company attack along a dry riverbed, but they did the same thing three times on the row within hours of each other, and the riverbed was just full of dead Japanese soldiers. So tactically, they were very limited in their ability to think and react to situations. When they had any doubt, it was banzai. So after 15 days, they were starving and out of supplies and ammunition, and it was a decisive victory demonstrating how the Japanese could be defeated and set the conditions for future victories at Imphal and Kohima later on that year. So it's a really good book, recommended.
Oh, I'm going to read that.
Yeah, I think we spoke about this before. I think there was a myth around the Japanese forces for a while.
Yeah.
And it had to be, I know, and I've mentioned this before, that the Chinbits, although tactically they may not achieve the strategic outcomes they wanted, but it proved that we took the fight to the Japanese, we went into their territory, and we destroyed that myth. So, you know, there was other successes during the Second World War against the Japanese forces.
The Chindas are actually very similar to the Japanese, and they were operating deep in the jungle, stretched lines of communication. And you look at the toll they took for sickness and death, non-combat casualties. They paid a hell of a price for what they did.
Absolutely. And Merrill's Marauders are exactly the same, but I think it was to change the mindset of the 14th Army, as it was then, the Forgotten Army, into taking the fight to the Japanese, like you say, stop the falling back, stop this impression of an invincible wave of Japanese, you know, these brilliant jungle fighters.
When you were on the course, was there any mention of the Indian Army during World War II and what they achieved?
No, do you know what? That's, as you were saying it, that was really strange. It's not something that I do recall. Don't get me wrong, they are proud of their honours and their battle honours, but the ones that I remember being discussed were the ones linked to those that were, you know, given and awarded post-independence. It really was there is almost, a shedding of the past. So there was one time when me and some of the sort of Western colleagues, friends of mine, that we took our bikes and we rode into Chennai. We had a weekend off in Chennai. I regret it because it was on a hell of a journey on a motorbike. But we went to Chennai, and when we got there, there were antique shops. They were selling sort of stuff from Days of Empire, and you could basically buy it for, it was worthless. Whereas the sort of local Indian sort of artifacts were really wealthy. So it's almost as if there was a degree of trying to shed the past. But again, it's quite strange, isn't it? But because you're right. I mean, they sacrificed so much, they gave so much, and they were and remain immensely brave soldiers, as you would imagine. They are ones that you would want by your side. There's nothing lacking in them. They have the courage, and as you know, that toll of VC speaks for itself, and they haven't changed. You know, I remember listening to the stories that some of my neighbours would recount in their sort of operational deployments. They are exactly what you would want.
My book is, again, going back over the last couple of episodes, the Cold War sort of theme. So mine's called The Cold War, A Very Short Introduction by Robert McCone. It's looking at the legacy of the Cold War and its impact on international relations during the Cold War and today. It shows that the Cold War was not just a Soviet and US sort of struggle, much wider. Obviously, it was global with proxy wars. It briefly covers the move of decolonization as we move past the Second World War and empires shrunk and revolutionary groups exploded onto the scene in Vietnam and places like that. And that had a massive impact on us. Obviously, the proxy wars in Korea, Vietnam, and obviously communism movements around in Africa. And we all tried to counter it with the global superpower competition. The book shows the US, the United States, and the Soviet Union became empires themselves over the course of the Cold War. So they became the new empires as such. And the security fears and needs shaped US and Soviet decisions from the beginning rather than economics. So the book covers 1945 to 1990. It's still an event that impacts Europe today. And my question to the listeners is, did the Cold War end in 1990, the fall of the war, or did we move into a new phase where Russia has taken over and it's taken them this long to move into that, obviously, the Ukraine today and its expansion, Syria, part of
Africa? I think a new phase is probably the way people have fallen in that direction these days, I think.
I think so. I think it has gone to that new phase. It just took a long time for it to bubble to the surface.
Yeah, I would agree. I think my brother is married to a Taiwanese Californian academic who obviously, you know, watches Taiwanese news all the time, and so that Russian Chinese viewpoint of the world, as she sees it in news reports that we don't get to see, And you're right. I think we're now seeing, because what is happening in Ukraine is only really part of a larger, you know, the larger issue of domination and rebalancing the world order. From, I think, what was in the press only yesterday, where with Russia now taking over the seat at the Security Council, and they're saying that it's pushing to rebalance the unipolar world order, and it wants to reset that. Yeah. You know, and that was an announcement made only yesterday. And the comment like that is no.
And it's also interesting to see that Modi was flexing his muscles with Putin last year. And kept Putin waiting, and told, you know, made his views of what was happening in Ukraine perfectly clear. So that just shows you the confidence that India now has on the world stage as well. And, you know, somebody like Putin has to listen to what they say.
Yeah, very much. And again, as a large industrial nation, you know, if we, again, I was tracking that last year, if we, the West, were cutting off supply lines for Russia to sell its supplies, the oil and gas still gets sold around the world. It just gets sold to a different customer. And in many ways, you know, the Indian government are, and its industry are very business savvy. And so, you know, in some respects, they were able to dictate to Russia, because if Russia wanted to sell its stock, then India would buy, because it's not constrained by a lot of the things that the West hold ourselves to, in terms of what, you know, we're going on in Europe with the gas. So you're right.
That's it for another episode. So thanks to John for coming to the podcast, and to you, the listener, for your continued support and suggestions. Please keep them coming, and our email and social media links are at the bottom of the show notes, as always. You can find us all the usual suspects, including Instagram, Facebook, YouTube and Twitter. And if you've downloaded us from iTunes and liked the pod, it'd be great if you give us a review there or anywhere you get your podcast from. And finally, thanks again to Nick Beale for his continuing support and sponsorship to the series, and offering technical help for his company ISAR. And we'll see you next time on The Unconventional Soldier.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.